And thanks to all of you for joining, and thanks especially to our guest of today, Mirjam Pilela. Let me say a word about her her background. You already have that in your invitation, so I don't need to spend much time on there. So Mirjam has spent a huge amount of time. She's currently the executive director of the Earth Charter, based in Costa Rica, and also the at the International Secretariat, and also for the Center of Education for Sustainable Development. And she has spent most of her career at the Earth Charter Initiative for more than 25 years. And I would say, like, I've looked at her work for the past 25 years at least, like, and she has made a significant contribution in this field. To share something personal, like, Mirjam and I studied together at Howard Kennedy School. One thing that I clearly remember from that time is her passion and her commitment for sustainable development and for climate change. I was glad to see that that has persisted over the years. So the structure for today's conversation, this is more of a fireside chat where we'll have a conversation where Mirjam can share her experiences and her perspectives. And I and Vanessa and others will ask a question, then we'll open up to everyone. So let me, without further ado, let's start. But let me start off with the obvious question, which is, working on sustainable development, climate change, and these questions requires huge amount of commitment. And there is, I can personally see that in our speaker of today. That's also reflected in some of the international agreements that we see, whether it's the Rio Charters, Millennium Development Goals, Sustainable Development Goals. But we often don't see the same commitment that we see in the framing of these agreements in their actual implementation on the ground. And since you have worked on both sides, so both in the framing of these charters and the international discussions, but also looked into their implementation. So maybe you can share something from your perspective and your experience, the kind of challenges that are faced in terms of both framing these or coming to international agreements, and also more importantly, in terms of their actual implementation on the ground. Why do we see such a big gap? Over to you, Mirjam.
Thank you, Adnan, and hello, everyone. It's good to send you greetings. I'm based here in Costa Rica on the campus of the University for Peace, which I just wanted to show you the beautiful day that we are having, if I may. I'm sitting on the campus here. We have a forest right in front of my office. I think I'm pretty privileged. Where we are located in the rural area of Costa Rica, and we have 300 hectares of protected area, just right where we are. And we have a center here that is focused on that intersection of sustainability, values, and education. So I would like to start answering the question, very complex question that Adnan asked, by saying that we are living in a world with a lot of complexities, right? Climate change, environment degradation, and I mean, there's the scale and complexities of the challenges that we currently have require they're huge in terms of scale, no? Of the current world challenges that are related to climate change, environment, unsustainability that we see everywhere. And therefore, to address the scale and complexities of these challenges, it requires concerted efforts, action, and collaboration. Normally, we look at the UN and we see the UN is the institution in charge of developing policies and implementing them. And the reality is that the UN doesn't have the capacity to do everything we think they have the capacity to do. And the same for our national governments. They do not necessarily have the capacity to develop policies and implement them because none of them, neither the UN nor the governments at the national level, have all the funds we think they have, neither the political will, and neither the information that is required to understand the challenges that we currently have. So I don't want to start with a very negative positioning, but it's actually a challenge that requires us not only to look at the tip of the iceberg in terms of the problems, but also what is underneath the root causes of the current problems we have, which many have to do with the institutions we have in place and the mental models and the worldviews that we have to address them. And I guess one of the key challenges has to do with the fragmentation of our system, the fragmentation of the UN as an institution, and the fragmentation of the way in which our governments are organized, our countries, country governments are organized. For instance, the Ministry of Environment of a country is supposed to take care and look for environmental policies and implementation of a country. And it's supposed to be part of the same team as the Ministry of Economics or the Ministry of Agriculture. But in reality, they're normally fighting as if they were not in the same team, right? But they are in the same team because they belong to the same government and they are trying to address the common good of a country. However, because the way in which our institutions are organized and the way in which funding even is prioritized, it makes things quite difficult to address policies in a concerted effort. So your question, Adnan, was why do we have such a difficulty to implement UN policies at the national level? I think there is a weakness in the way in which we see good governance at the UN level, at the international level, but also good governance at the national level. Good governance requires to recognize that given the scale of the current challenges, no institution can address it alone. Concerted efforts require institutional collaboration. And this means that in order to identify and understand the challenge that we have, in order to develop policies to address them in an informed way, and finally, in order to implement and monitor the policies and report about them, we need to recognize that no institution can do it alone, neither the UN nor governments. It's clear that the task is huge and this cannot lie in the hands of a single group nor an institution. The UN doesn't have the capacity, governments do not have the capacity, neither academia, civil society, nor the private sector have the capacity to understand the challenges alone or develop policies alone, or neither, let alone implement them. But each one of them, each one of these actors have an important role to play. This means that we have to rethink the way we look at good governance. We know that governance, we should know that governance involves, especially good governance, involves policy instruments, institutional or in financing mechanisms that manage and regulate the processes of global environmental protection, for instance, no? So it's policies, institutions, and the finances in place. And they are not all the time placed in a coherent way, right? Sometimes we have policy instruments, but we do not have the institutional mechanisms to implement the policies. Many times we have a policy instrument, but we do not have a financial mechanism to actually help implement the policies that have been developed. So we do need to take a serious look at how to rethink the way in which good governance is taking place at the international level and at the national level. At WRI, the World Resources Institute, in one of their reports issued back in 2005, around 2005, highlighted that how we decide and who gets to decide our policies often determines what will be decided, which means that depending on who we call to be sitting on the table to define, to develop a policy, the direction may be completely different. So again, for the past 30 years, the UN has been, I think, trying to innovate how to open the doors to invite different groups to sit on the table to help the decision-making process. And the reason for that is because when there is a participatory process of decision-making, participatory process for policy development, it generates a bigger sense of ownership and commitment to implement of different from different actors. It also gives legitimacy to the decision-making process that not only one group is in charge of developing a policy. When we open the doors also for a real participatory process involving different actors and sectors to identify the issues, identify the challenges, to come up with a financial and institutional mechanisms to implement the policies, it helps to vocalize the interests of different groups and persons that are normally not well represented in a process. And the different actors that I'm referring to are first the UN Secretariat, national governments, local governments, academics, private sector, civil society in general, all having an important role to play in developing policies to make sure we keep as a way to shrink the gap of policy development and policy implementation. Let me make a point about the relationship between the United Nations and national governments. Normally, the United Nations sets the agenda and organize or facilitate a negotiation process to develop a policy. But actually the ones who sit on the table and make the decision and the negotiations on how a policy on climate change or sustainability is developed are the national governments. So the national governments are actually the ones who have the ultimate words to agree on a policy. They're of course influenced more and more over the past 30 to 40 years. They're more and more influenced by groups of scientists, academics, civil society, NGOs, etc. But the last word is actually the governments, no, that decide and agree upon a policy at the UN level. However, when they go back to their countries, it's as if there's a fragmentation on the commitment of something that was agreed within the UN level and when it has to be brought to the national level, as if it was a different country. So, but it is not. So let's take the example, Mexico or Costa Rica. No? Mexico, Costa Rica sit on the table to agree upon the UN climate change agreements and many policies or the UN SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goal. They are there, they spent 3 years negotiating a UN policy as part of the process. Hopefully they engage the different actors in helping them to further, to expand their understanding on the issues, the priority areas, because again, governments alone cannot understand the scale and complexities of issues. They require they need to embrace knowledge that comes from these different sectors in various ways. So they sit on the table for 3 years or so, negotiating a policy, a UN policy. They agree upon it, they have vested interests, right? And then when it comes to the time to bring it back to the country for ratification and for implementation, is as if they didn't know about what was being negotiated or what was being agreed. It stays within the sphere of certain people or sectors that were closely involved in the negotiation process. So there's a huge, it requires a huge effort of communication first, I would say, to communicate what has been agreed within the UN level and what a government has committed and has the responsibility to bring back to their country and actually implement them, right? So I think in order to address your question, one of the big challenges has to do with the fragmentation of the institution, actually. The institution within the UN, because there are many institutions doing things that are relatively similar. I'll show you a little bit in the policies regarding education. So there's a fragmentation within the UN and there's a fragmentation within the governmental institutions to actually implement them. And then a gap of how to bring in the commitments and responsibilities taken at the international level, bringing it to the national level requires another huge set of actors to be involved. Again, it's not only the national government, it's not only the Ministry of Environment or the Ministry of Education or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that set on the table at the international level, that has the capacity to bring it back at the national level to implement all of this, right? So it often happens that a negotiator of a Ministry of Foreign Affairs join efforts with a negotiator from or someone who, an expert from the Ministry of Environment of a country, sits on the table for 3 years to develop an environmental policy on something at the UN level. When they come back home, they require a lot of traction and political will at different levels, not only the presidential level, but at different levels to make that, to incorporate that commitment into the national engines of a government. So there's certainly a huge challenge that we need to really open and see why this is happening. And I think one of them has to do with fragmentation of the way in which policies are developed, fragmentations in terms of the way in which organizations are set and funding. If I may, I would like to share just a specific example. And I may actually, to make it easier, I'm gonna share actually a screen. If I can have the share screen option.
Yeah, I can make you the host so you can do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna, because I know it's a bit abstract what I'm saying, so I'm gonna try to share something very specific.
Sure, please do.
Okay, so this has to do with the something that I guess all of us have heard or know is the UN Sustainable Development Goals. This is at the top of the current UN agenda. There are 17 goals. Each goal has a lot of things in it. Each goal is related to other UN agendas, right? One of the goals, let me actually try to, one second. Let's see here. One of the goals is related to the goal of education, SDG 4. is quality education. Just come back, just one second. Let me share this again with you. Okay, so it has to do with the SDG 4, which is related to quality education, that is in a way related to all the other sustainable development goals. And each, and several of the sustainable development goals have something to do with education. So let me go to specifics. So we have SDG 13 is specifically related to climate change. And it's basically a goal in which by 2030, all governments would have achieved a certain number of agreements or targets inside the framework of the Sustainable Development Goal. But that is, of course, related to the climate change, the United Nations framework on climate change that was first agreed on in 92, then again in 97, and then the latest version of that is the Paris Agreement that was agreed in 2015. So inside that agenda, there is Article 6. Article 6 of the Climate Change First Agreement and Article 12 of the Paris Agreement has to do with the importance of has to do with the commitment of governments to incorporate climate change in education all across the curriculum. It has to do with government's commitment to raise awareness on climate change and to generate various ways to promote awareness and education around climate change, right? So that's Article 6 of the Climate Change Agreement Framework and Article 12 of the Paris Agreement. That are seen at the UN level, the institution that is in charge of moving ahead with that is the United Nations Secretariat on Climate Change, right? At the government level, in principle, is the Ministry of Environment of countries everywhere. However, the agenda of education in any country is not necessarily led, it's actually not led by the ministries of environment. It's generally the ministries of education that set the policies on agendas of education, right? And ministries of education normally do not sit on the table of a climate change negotiation. So it's as if there is something inside the climate change negotiation that was agreed upon that has to do with education all over the world, but the main agency at the national level was not sitting on the table. So it's as if someone goes to a UN negotiation, comes back to the country and say, there was an agreement, we have the responsibility and the commitment to implement Article 6 of the Climate Change Agreement and Article 12. And the institution that is in charge of education in the country doesn't know about that. Doesn't have the commitment, neither the responsibility to do that. But the UN generates funds from some countries to implement partly some of these policies. In the Biodiversity Convention that was also agreed in 1992, there is an Article 12 and Article 13 that has to do with the importance to incorporate education on biodiversity in all aspects of learning. It, of course, has to do with SDG 12, 13, 14. And what I'm trying to articulate here is that in the UN, these policies are developed in a fragmented way, but also funding in the way in which the UN could help to implement some of these policies are also organized in a fragmented way because there are different UN institutions in charge of these different UN policies, but the UN, some many of these UN policies are very related to one another. Another example, the 10 YFP that you see below, it's basically a UN effort to develop a 10-year framework program on that has to do with sustainable production and consumption, and also has to do with education. So the UN agency that is behind that is UN Environment, UNEP. So UNEP has a specific mandate to implement that policy, that agreement, that UN framework that has to do with education for sustainable lifestyles. But that policy is, again, is there is a one institution in charge. Climate change is basically another institution, which is the UN Secretariat on Climate Change. The Biodiversity Convention is another institution, that's the UN Secretariat on Biodiversity, right? But they're all working to try to ask governments to develop policies and programs to that could incorporate either climate change, biodiversity, or education for sustainable lifestyle into education. And they go and they all believe that primary, secondary school teachers all around the world will easily implement these policies that are presented to them in a fragmented way. And let alone the governments don't necessarily, have not yet taken, most of them have not yet taken the step to develop a national policy that is coherent and that brings together all these policies under one umbrella. So that makes it pretty complicated because the institutions are fragmented and funding is also fragmented in the way in which these policies could be implemented. One last example, you see that Incheon Education 2030. So since 2015, the year that the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals were launched, UNESCO has been spending significant effort in developing what they call the Education 2030. So it's a whole agenda that was launched in 2015. And this year they are launching again, new policy frameworks to further implement education for sustainable development or education for global citizenship. That agenda is articulated, promoted and monitored by UNESCO. UNESCO doesn't necessarily have the capacity neither the role to implement it at the national level, let alone the local level. UNESCO requires the collaboration of national governments and institutions all around schools and universities to be able to actually implement the Education 2030 new policy framework on education that has a lot to do with incorporating education for sustainable development, climate change education, biodiversity education into all aspects of learning. So it's kind of all of that I'm trying to share with you that there's a lot of good policies out there, but a lot of gap in coordination in making all these policies coherent so that it makes it easier to be implemented at the level that it needs to be implemented. Now, again, governments go and sit on these different tables, either the Sustainable Development Goals or the table that as part of the UNESCO negotiations around policies on education 2030. But when they come back home, there is a huge gap in terms of their capacity and their political will knowledge, communication, and funding to actually implement, which basically result in a huge gap. And it also result on the fact that governments select based on their priorities, based on their contexts, what among all these many policies are the ones that they choose or select that they say, okay, we can maybe implement 10% of all of this in our national context. A lot of that decision is also based on funding that governments receive. So for instance, there are some governments that are specific in terms of ODA, overseas development aid, or in terms of international cooperation when it comes to funding. The government of Japan, for instance, has a specific interest in funding and in making sure the implementation of the whole UN and UNESCO agenda on ESD, Education for Sustainable Development, takes place. And therefore the government of Japan has been funding that. The government of South Korea has a specific interest at the UN UNESCO level on the agenda of, on global citizenship education. That in a way, it's relatively similar to the agenda of Education for Sustainable Development. But the South Korean government is funding UNESCO and some other governments to help them implement the agenda on global citizenship education. But the reality is that the majority of countries around the world lack the political will and the concerted effort and funding to implement most of this agenda, especially when they see there are so many of them. They all have a different label, a different name, a different institution that is behind them and different funding. Makes it even more complicated. So we have been looking at this and trying to articulate with governments, at least here in Central America, to see this with an integrated, and this many different policies, with an integrated systemic approach, and see it with an umbrella, develop a sort of a one umbrella under which they could put many of these policies, at least around the issue of education or new approaches to education, in one national program or one national policy. So for instance, in Costa Rica, we helped the national government in Costa Rica to develop a policy on education for sustainable development, following the agreements since 2015 on the Education 2030 agenda, but a policy that they could address not only ESD, Education for Sustainable Development, but also under that umbrella, or that umbrella policy, they could address climate change education, education for biodiversity, education for sustainable lifestyle, or even education for global citizenship. Because at the national level, it makes it just much easier if there is one integrated approach, and certainly at the very local level, when a local government or a school or even a school teacher at that very local level needs to implement, it makes it much easier for someone to see all these policies that are related to one another under one similar umbrella with an integrated approach. So I think, and I hope I was able to share some of these challenges of policy making that has to do with different agendas that are sometimes seen in a fragmented way, and the need to recognize the important role of different actors that are not only things do not lie only in the hands of the UN. The development and implementation of these policies do not only lie in the hands of government, but it requires a sort of the role of a good governance or the role of the government as in a way that they could articulate, facilitate a process that in which they can bring together different actors that have something to contribute to each one of these different policies. Let me know if you have other questions.
Thank you so much. Miriam, this was super interesting. So fragmentation of institutional interest hinder coordination and implementation, and also hinder collective action. Not push back, but let me try to build the argument and ask you a follow-up question. So, by the way, I found your analogies quite interesting. Who sits at the table decides what is decided, which also reminds me about Graham Allison's work at Howard Kennedy School about the Cuban Missile Crisis and how, and one pithy summary of his work is, where you stand depends on where you sit. So, which is institutional interest of different agencies, in that case, Ministry of Defense versus Ministry of State Department and others, they have their own institutional interests that prevent, and agencies are interested in promoting or advancing their institutional interests, and that prevents that kind of coherent policy making. And that's relevant, and his work shows that's relevant even for a country like the US, and it would have stark consequences. So one follow-up question from what you're saying, which is super interesting, is we have international agreements, and many of those agreements are not followed up, are not implemented, but could it partly be part of the original sin? I'm saying it could either be that some countries enter into agreement that they have no intention of following up. Think of Mobutu of the world. Yes, you could enter into agreements for isomorphic mimicry. It looks good on your CV, or it gives you some international legitimacy. It gives it sounds good for the country. Maybe it gives you some legitimacy and some resources, but you're never interested. And other countries who may be interested, but then who find it difficult, and you mentioned challenges of capacity, coherence within countries, and maybe lack of coordination between different policy actors. Those who show up in international agreements are not necessarily the ones who make the decisions within country, but it could also be because of political incentives. And my question is, are we maybe approaching it these questions from the wrong way around? Should we first think of international agreements and then start thinking about how countries implement them? Or we should think of what is the domestic political economy that supports certain type of decisions? And if that doesn't exist, how should we promote that? For instance, any politician would find it difficult if there is not enough of a consensus or a domestic support as to why he or she is spending enough money on, say, education or climate change, especially on policies which are domestically unpopular, and sometimes they are, as to whether he or she is doing it because the UN asked them to do this, or they had to enter into some agreement, or they're doing it for domestic reasons. We want doing it because we mean the good of our country, or whatever the narrative is. So any reflections on how do we address this? What do you see as the sources of this problem? How do we begin correcting this? And have you seen any examples where we have made progress on these issues, despite all of those challenges?
Examples on what? I couldn't hear that well.
So any examples where there has been effective follow-up of international agreements, or there has been progress, and so some success stories, and what do we learn from those?
Well, I think the first point on whether maybe some countries are sitting on the table, but they do not necessarily have an interest. I think countries have so many different interests. And certainly it depends on the context of each country. But the reality that we live nowadays is that we live in such an interdependent world. The current pandemic is an example of that. What is done in one country affects another country, right? So it's not just about whether you want to do or do not want to do, it will affect the community, right? Beyond the borders of that country. So climate change is certainly a good example for that. Also that it seems to me that it's not really a choice of whether it's an important thing or not for the country, because it's part of a responsibility to belong to a global community in which you contribute with the collective of the global community, either in good or in bad, and you have to take the responsibility of how much you have contributed, either in good or bad, to a given situation. So there's a principle in common but differentiated responsibility that has to do with something that countries have been promoting more and more on the importance for all of us, independently of which region or context of the world, all countries need to have to take their responsibility with regards to how to address climate change. Some will have more capacity, others will have more knowledge, more power, more finances to address it. But I think it needs to be recognized that indeed, there are different levels of capacity to address climate change from depending on which country is there. So, but it is true that many countries sit on a table that they do not think it's necessarily a priority for them. And when therefore they agree on many things that are not necessarily a priority, and therefore it makes it even more difficult when they go back home and need to implement it to actually make it happen. So for instance, I have been in dialogue with several countries in Central America to try to implement some of these agreements, especially with regards to Article 6 of climate change that has to do with education, or the new UNESCO 2030 agenda on education for sustainable development. And when it comes to some countries such as El Salvador or Honduras, that they have so many other problems and priorities to ensure access to education, quality education. For them, developing a policy on climate change education sounds as if it is a luxury that they don't have, because they have other priorities that needs to be addressed in the midst of a lot of limitations. Limitations in terms of finances, in terms of human capacity, in terms of knowledge. So this happens everywhere. What makes it easier for them to make a decision is when there is a funding behind it. So for instance, Dominican Republic is a country in our region here that has taken serious the whole agenda to implement education for climate change. Again, it's an agreement. In the Paris Agreement, Article 12, and in the Climate Change Convention, Article 6, it's there. It's already an agreement at the UN level. But they have taken it very seriously because, A, Dominican Republic is an island that has a vested interest in trying to address issues around climate change, and B, because they received international cooperation that came with knowledge and funding to implement that at the national level in Dominican Republic, you know, as an example of how a country transforms and makes it become a priority for them. It depends, A, on their context, of course, on the political will, and whether there is a specific funding that comes from international cooperation to help them bring that into action.
Yeah, well said. Context definitely matters. If I were in Maldives and the island was going to disappear, the rising seas, I obviously that focuses attention, concentrates minds, as they say. So this is great. Let's now open up. Let me first invite my colleague, who basically essentially organizes, co-organizes, in fact, leads on these policy practice seminars, Vanessa Rubio. She, as I mentioned, has huge experience on in different ministries in Mexico. So Vanessa, over to you.
Thank you so much, Adnan, and thank you, Miriam. It was really insightful what you presented today to us, and so frank and real at the same time, because I hear you. I know what that complexity is all about. And I was thinking, usually the tension between the implementation of international commitments, like sustainable commitments in this case, comes in collision with financing. So basically, the mean guys always are the ministers of finance, which I represented for over 15 years. And one thing that I always enhanced is the relevance of involving finance ministries in the negotiation of the commitments. Because like all the different ministries will come to us and would say, well, we have this commitment and we have this other commitment and we have that commitment. And you're like, when was this commitment made and why wasn't budget considered, you know? So I'm trying to put a word here in favor of finance ministries in terms of how relevant it is, I think, for finance ministries to have an international division that deals with all of these commitments and can actually, you know, support the rest of the negotiations in the wide area of commitments that a country has, no? Because otherwise you don't get that sense of ownership that you were describing in terms of the international community before the commitment is made, no? So once the commitment is made, then you need to mobilize resources and you need to do whatever you can to try to be able to fulfill those commitments. But at the end, it's like a step before, I think, that one needs to see when getting committed to all of this. I think that there's imperfect information within the agencies. I think there's imperfect incentives, imperfect understanding, imperfect degrees of consciousness, if I may say, and that's a fact. And I think one of the complexities you unveiled here was international governance of these subjects. When I was in finance, I remember one time I asked my team for some information on the Paris Agreement. And it was quite difficult to map, to even have a map. And this I'm mentioning to the students for the capstone projects and for the research projects. There's no map internationally. Like just imagine a huge map where you have the Paris Accord, the SDGs, but also the Rio Charter and all of the international commitments and that you can click, a link and that takes you to the whatever the commitment is. There's no map like that in the world. I bet on that. Because you cannot see in one single page or in two single pages where is all the commitments and the levels and who is part of what and who is not part of what, no? And that is even very complicated, like for step one, just to understand what the international governance scheme of this kind of international commitments are. And another topic that I would like your comments on, Miriam, if you please, is the fact that some of the commitments, like the SDG charter you were explaining to us, were made under very different circumstances, but the commitments continue as if nothing has happened. No, so the 0.7% for international development and the, all the percentages that we agreed on that those SDGs, I was a part of them, that we agreed at a certain point are static and they don't evolve with the new realities, no? What about, for example, I was telling this to my students the other day, what about the new reality vis-a-vis the SDGs? Do we need a new summit for financing for development to understand what we should do with the SDGs? Because we're not going to be making it for the 2030 in many of the commitments. But we're not going to be making it because we had structural problems, but because we got hit by the worst crisis or dual crisis ever in history. So what about perhaps being more frank, being more open, and say, we're not going to be making it for 2030. And instead of moving forward as if nothing has happened, no, as, I don't listen, I don't see, what if we reconsider some of the commitments and make them viable under the new context? Thank you so much again for being with us today.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe on the last point, I think UN policies are often being revised, revisited over and over. And it is certainly true that we'll probably not, we have 10 more years to reach 2030 in principle to implement all the 17 SDGs. And the reality is that most probably they are not going to be implemented. The way I see these UN policies is that they help to set a goal. They are very helpful in setting a common agenda. They are very helpful sometimes in organizing international collaboration and in international funding for countries that need the most to for them to be implemented. I never really would expect a UN policy to be fully implemented by the target date that they, but it doesn't mean that they are not important. I think it's extremely important to develop these policies because it sets a common agenda for international cooperation. It sets a common vision, a common goal. But we also need to just recognize the reality is that countries are in different contexts with different capacities. Some have good political will and good, strong leadership. And again, I do not think that what countries need is to have a lot of money at the governmental level or even a strong leadership. I think what we need is to have a kind of leadership in our countries that function as facilitators of a process. A country leadership at the governmental level that can recognize that the government cannot do it alone because the government do not have all the information and the government do not have all the capacity. And therefore, what we need is to have more leaders with a capacity to articulate a process with different actors, recognizing, well, look, I am the Minister of Environment and I'm in charge of implementing policy X, but I need to first recognize that I cannot implement all of that. And therefore I need to articulate a process at the national level with local governments, with state governments at the governmental level, with different institutions, with the academia, with the private sector, with the civil society organizations. What I need to do is not to own the process or to be the only one in a vertical way that has the capacity to implement it, because this is not going to happen. What we need is leaders with a view that can recognize their vulnerability and their limitations and their need to establish collaboration in various levels, to look at all these many different policies and see how much they can implement from a partnership approach, not an approach that we, my institution, can do it all by ourselves, because this is not going to happen. But this requires capacity to listen, capacity to articulate with different sectors at the not in a vertical way, but in a horizontal way. It's I think it's one of the most important things that we need nowadays in order to develop and implement the policies that are needed to address the challenges that we currently have, is that kind of capacity to articulate dialogue with different sectors of our societies, and to through that dialogue to establish a strong collaboration in which all the actors share a common purpose. So sharing a common purpose, setting a goal is important. So coming back to the international level, the SDGs or the climate change agreements, they set a common purpose. They set a common purpose, a common agenda. And I think they are important in that way. What we need is to bring that to the level at the national level, local level, in various institutional levels to articulate that in a way that it can, that each sector will understand its role in implementing bits and pieces of this puzzle, because it's actually a puzzle. Another thing you mentioned, I think, was the first one on the Minister of Finance, City on the Table. I think it's absolutely crucial, because again, that's why there is so much problems in the implementation of these policies, is that one arm of a government goes, negotiates a policy, and then come back and doesn't have the traction to bring it at the national level and implement it. In Costa Rica, there is something very interesting. There is a former Minister of Finance in Costa Rica that is a finance person, has been a finance person all his life. And he suddenly became interested in issues around environment and biodiversity because he was asked to go into one of these international meetings of biodiversity. And he says it helped him to open his eye because he always saw, he confesses that he always saw things in a fragmented way. And he never gave the value or the importance of environmental biodiversity negotiations. But by having him attend and take part in some of these negotiations helped, educated him and opened his eyes to look at the value of the biodiversity, the value of the environment. And since then they have been developing actually how in Costa Rica can have an account for the biodiversity and the environment here. This is actually part of a UNDP project called BioFin, which is biodiversity and finance, bringing these two together to make sure ministries of finance take it very serious. I think it requires long-term thinking and systemic thinking for each one of the leaders that we have nowadays. So again, be it a finance minister, economic minister, or even environment minister, agriculture minister, all our leaders are currently with a huge need to be educated about long-term thinking, responsibility with the consequences of our decisions, the short and long-term consequences of our decision. So long-term thinking education, I would say, and system thinking, systems literacy, I think it's required. So, because the reality is that we have a number, most policymakers, most decision makers in different levels are making a lot of decisions, but with little information and actually being almost complete illiterate when it comes to ecology, environment, and systemic illiterate, which means that decisions are made without looking at the consequences in various sectors and also in the long run. So I would say ministers of finances and all the other government officials and leaders need to go through a basic training on systemic approach, eco-literacy, and et cetera. especially the people that, of course, are around them. And in terms of the map that you mentioned, it's certainly a wonderful idea because each time there is a major UN convention agreed, there is a UN secretariat that's formed, right? So in 1992, at the Earth Summit, the Climate Change Secretariat was created in order to follow up the Climate Change Agreement. Each time a UN secretariat is created, it requires funds, right? To funds to make sure that UN agency works. And the funds come from the governments, of course, international cooperation. The Biodiversity Secretariat that is located in Canada was created to follow up the Biodiversity Convention and so forth. UNEP, the UN Environment that is based in Kenya, was created also to follow up and monitor many of the UN environment agreements. But so just by saying this, you can see that there are many UN agencies that are looking at similar UN policies and agenda related to environment or sustainable development, but they function in a completely different or fragmented way. Each one has their portfolios, agenda, and funding. And when it comes to a conversation about collaboration, it gets very complicated because people defend their sphere, their space. Agencies and institutions become very territorial, as you know, in account at the national level too. So very territorial, no? The Ministry of Education with the Ministry of Environment and the Ministry of Agriculture, Finance, very territorial. They each one have their agenda. So again, coming back to the importance of articulating bridges between these different territories is extremely important. It requires the capacity of various leaders to be willing to extend their arm and make bridges. So talking about the map, I have been also looking at this from the lenses of education, right? Because I was trying to show you just from the lenses of education, each one of these UN major agreements, the Climate Change Agreement, the Biodiversity Agreement Convention, the SDGs, and some others, many of them have an article, a point that has to do with education. Oh, it's important to incorporate biodiversity in education. It's important to bring climate change into education at the national level. But again, they function fragmented because they're inside each umbrella. They're inside the underneath the umbrella of each of these conventions. However, at the implementation level, at the local level, this requires a bridge. It requires an integrated approach. And that's not easy. I see that the current agenda that the UN is launching with education is an effort that the UNESCO is trying to address as an effort with SDG 4, with Education 2030 Agenda. It's an international policy on education because the UN normally sets education priorities, you know, for the governments. For us, just so that we understand, in 1990, the UN had a first meeting to set the priorities of international cooperation on education in the year 2002. And for 20 years, the priority was on literacy. The priority was on to ensure more people around the world have access to basic education. And over the past 10 to 15 years, this has slightly been changed. and the focus of international cooperation agenda around education is on the quality of education. So UNESCO has been working on an effort to organize or make bridges around these various different agendas that has to do with education under a common policy agenda, which is Education 2030 that UNESCO is currently articulating with all our governments around the world. They're supposed to implement the Education 2030 agenda that UNESCO started to launch in 2015. This year, together with the German government, UNESCO is launching the new framework for 2030 that emphasizes the importance of ESD, Education for Sustainability, in all national policies. So I see, in a way, I see a lot of possibilities, because I think there's more and more understanding at the international level on the need to have a more coherence, on the need to bring together these different agendas in one integrated approach. I think this new global ESD, the UNESCO calls it ESD, Education for Sustainable Development for 2030 framework. And they are launching it together with the government of German and many other governments this year. But they recognize that in order to implement this agenda, and actually the SDGs too, it requires the active participation and support, not only of governments, but of civil society and different actors of society all over. So there is a recognition, and therefore there are more and more possibilities of collaboration, because there is a common understanding that the answers to all these challenges cannot only come from the UN, neither from a government, but it can only emerge out of a strong collaboration among different actors.
Great, thank you. Vanessa, thank do you want to come in to follow up, or do you have?
No, basically, I very much appreciate your answer, and I totally agree. And I think that these, in terms of educating the rest of the agencies to have a consciousness of the, you know, the long-term effects of decision-making and environment in general, I think that these projects that you were referring to as the Biofin, and it was Biofin or something like that,
yes,
are excellent that we have that. No, I was invited, I remember, 2 years ago to participate in a Chatham House exercise where they put us inside a room, a financial sector specialist and climate scientifics. So we were there for 3 days and we were, and it was quite interesting. And the result was how to incorporate, environmental aspects into financial risk assessment. It was an impressive exercise, but the more and more these two different, worlds interact and are intertwined and understand each other, the better for policy making, I think, at the domestic level and international levels. So thank you so much for your answer on this.
You know, given that you are from Mexico, let me mention a very good example that I think comes from Mexico in terms of implementing a policy. Because I think that was a question that Adnan asked a long time ago about an example. So in 1992, when the Rio Earth Summit took place, the main agreement document was called Agenda 21. And there was a whole section on Agenda 21 that emphasized the importance of institution mechanisms to implement the Agenda 21 that needed to be multi-sectoral. So the government of Mexico worked, I think, for about over 20 years with the UNDP in what they called the National Councils for Sustainable Development, National Consultative Councils for Sustainable Development, Consejos Consultivos para Desarrollo Sustentable. And this was only, actually now that I think, it was only possible because there was a political will from the government of Mexico inside the Ministry of Environment, SEMARNAT, and the financial support from UNDP and technical support from the UN Development Program. And that program was in place for about 20 years, which was there to ensure there was always when a policy was to be developed, there was a multi-stakeholder dialogue at the various, all the 32 states in Mexico. Mexico has 32 states. Each state, they set up a state council, multi-stakeholder, involving the voices of women, farmers, private sector, the academic, youth representatives, etc., to help design or influence an environmental policy at the most in a kind of participatory way. In that way, Mexico was implementing Principle 10 of the Rio Declaration that has to do with ensuring public participation in decision-making and policy-making. In that way, Mexico was implementing Agenda 21 for over 20 years and building capacity of the society and the different sectors of society to help the government to design, develop, and implement policies. So I'm just mentioning this as a concrete example that I think it's one of the few countries in the world that really managed to set up an institutional mechanism to ensure the participation of various actors of the society to kind of help the government in developing and implementing these environmental policies.
Well, thank you very much, Marianne. It was a wonderful session, great insights, perfect topic. I really enjoyed it. I think our students and our listeners will also have enjoyed it. You touched on some very, very interesting but also intractable questions. Lots of challenges. You also shared your insights, but those questions are so big that we can keep on discussing them for a long time.
It's huge. I always find incredible that our countries go, sit on the table, discuss and agree, and when they go back, it's as if they have forgotten what was agreed upon because of lack of capacity in general.
So thank you very much again for agreeing to talk. It was a fascinating discussion. We thoroughly enjoyed it and hope to see you maybe physically at some point. So thank you very much.
Yes, my pleasure.
For my colleague, Vanessa, Jemima, everyone, our students, thank you very much.
Thank you, Adnan, Jemina, and Vanessa. All the best.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.